As you can tell from the Star Wars theme sung by a cat, this is the Martian Drive-In Podcast number 39, Everything That's Wrong with Star Wars. My name's Terry Frost, and that's what I'm doing this time around. I'm looking at the first three Star Wars movies, which for some reason, probably to do with a brain tumour, George Lucas has decided are the fourth, fifth and sixth movies in the series. Thank you very much to my friend Jane, who donated the money that I said I required to actually do this podcast about these particular movies. It's a mixed blessing. So, Jane, thank you for your money, but I think you've been very, very mean to me for doing it. There are a few other people I need to thank for the production of this podcast. Everybody who listens, of course, and I'm sure that there are a number of people who are just waiting to hear what I say about this thing. But in particular, my friend Shane Morrissey, who created and is the president of Star Walking, the Australian Star Wars fan club. Shane's been very, very supportive of this for reasons that I really do not understand, but he has been supportive of me dissing Star Wars and has given me a couple of links towards things that have helped with the research for the podcast. And I also need to thank my friend Matt Curran for lending me the movies, because I wasn't going to buy them. Matt lent me all three of the original Star Wars movies. They are the redone ones, and I'll talk a little bit later about what I think about George Lucas painting over his own movies. But so that's pretty much what this podcast is going to be about. I'm going to be covering Star Wars, I'm going to be covering The Empire Strikes Back, and I'm going to be covering Return of the Jedi. To be honest with you, I'll give you a bit of a spoiler at the start of this. I didn't like them. But having said that, I'm going to now do the contact details and then we will get on with the show. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is, it could be all the way from George Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In Podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. The Star Wars movies are a little bit like the Catholic Church. If you had early exposure to it, chances are you're going to look fondly upon it for the rest of your life. I didn't have a particularly early one because it came out when I was 20. Which is not my fault, but yes, it was a phenomenon at the time, but I've seen it since, and every time I've watched it since that first time, when I was dazzled by the special effects just like everybody else was, I kind of worked out that it's piss poor and ordinary in a lot of ways, and it's also had a detrimental effect on science fiction cinema. So many movies after this one tried to emulate the brain-dead effects-driven storylines of Star Wars and did even worse than Star Wars did. So, the first one I'm going to look at, of course, is Star Wars. Now, a lot of people call it Star Wars A New Hope, but then when I first saw it, it didn't have as many pretensions, so it's just Star Wars to me and to a lot of people of my generation. So what I'm going to do is do a little bit of a pricey from IMDb or somewhere like that, and then ask a bunch of questions about Star Wars, which don't really get answered much. Yes, I realise it was supposed to be a kids' film, but there's still a lot of weird shit in there that really does weaken the possibilities of the story. Okay, so here's the pricey from IMDb. Luke Skywalker joins forces with a Jedi Knight, a cocky pilot, a Wookiee and two droids to save the universe from the Empire's world-destroying battle station, while also attempting to rescue Princess Leia from the evil Darth Vader. And that's it. So I'm going to start asking a few questions about this film, which I kind of wanted answers to, but I didn't really get them. So first off, we start off on Luke Skywalker's home planet of Tatooine, which sounds a bit like a place where you would get piercings done. But my question is this. How do you get oxygen on a desert planet? Oxygen is a product of plants. They grab carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, they metabolize it and use what they want from it, probably the carbon, and produce oxygen. How do you do that on a desert planet? Why aren't people basically choking to death all the time? And that's another issue with this movie series. You've got the one climate planet thing happening there. So you've got Tatooine, which is a desert planet. You've got Hoth, which is an ice planet. You've got Dagobah, which is a swamp planet. You've got Bespin, which is a city floating on a whole bunch of clouds on what may or may not be a gas giant. Everything's just one note, which is really weird for me. It shows lazy storytelling, and it kind of doesn't really work for me for that reason. So that's the very first thing. I'm not even going to go into the thing about spaceships making noise in space. It really doesn't pan out. That one, you can kind of get endlessly into the problems of the physics of spaceships and all that kind of thing, but I'm going to leave that one aside. That battle on the Rebel spaceship at the start, the one where Princess Leia gets flattened out and the droids get launched off to Tatooine and all that kind of thing, that really is weird, because both the Rebels and the Stormtroopers would have got taken out by a bunch of stone Vietnam War veterans. They do not know anything about military tactics at all. They're clumsy, they're stupid, and the choreography of the action is atrociously bad. They don't know anything about tactics. Nobody can shoot straight unless it's important to a major plot point. And the other part about that that really does get me is, how the fuck do you run a galactic empire when your main soldiers wear shiny white armor? In most environments, they are going to stand out like a beacon, and that's going to make them targets. It really is ill-considered. There is not an army on the on our planet that would go out to fight anything wearing shiny white stuff unless they were going out into the Arctic tundra or something like that. And the weird thing is, too, I mean, these rebels are on a spaceship. They know they're getting invaded by the other guys. Surely you'd improvise a few booby traps or a few IEDs or something like that to take out a few of the soldiers. They could have basically stopped the Death Star right at the start by taking out Darth Vader with an improvised explosive device, even if it was just a propane tank with a flare on it. But no, none of this stuff matters, because George Lucas is a director that who's in it for the technology. He's not in it for the storytelling. He's not in it for the characters. George Lucas started out life as a rev head. He was into cars and car racing, and he's into mechanical things. He's not really into the storytelling from a people point of view. Yes, he did go through film school with a whole bunch of people who made fantastic directors, who were some of the greatest directors of the later half of the 20th century, at least from the American point of view. But George really didn't have the clout for that. What he was good at was the technology side of it. He put this movie together, and once this movie hit, a few realizations would have come to him. The first one was that the merchandise is worth more than the movie. The movie's second and third one, and then the other three, and the ones that are going to be in the future, they're basically there for one simple reason, and that is to sell toys. The toys make a lot more money than the films do. The films are just the hook for the toys. And given that you've got that approach to things, it doesn't really matter if the story makes any sense at all, because they're still going to sell the toys. They're going to sell the bums on seats to the tickets, which is not an inconsiderable amount of money. But the money is really in the merch, and as long as you can get people to buy the toys, everything else doesn't really matter. And we've got to talk a little bit about Princess Leia's plan. So her plan, given the fact that the Empire grabs the spaceship she's on, she decides to send two ill-equipped robots to a desert planet, dumps them down at random on the planet, and tells them to find one guy on the entire planet. Not only that, but neither robot is at all suited to desert terrain. One of them's a whiny little bitch, and the other one beeps and whistles all the time and has shiny lights on top of it, which all through the three movies pissed me off enormously, because R2-D2 would not shut the fuck up. He was beeping and booping and whistling. He's got those red and blue lights on his head, and yet they take him into places that require a great deal of stealth. You might as well just go in there in an ambulance with the siren going. It really is stupid. Why take this dumb robot with you? And that brings up the other thing in the series. The robots shouldn't be there at all. There's nothing in this movie that couldn't have been done by humans, pretty much. Why invent a whole bunch of high-maintenance robots who are going to wander around and get themselves in trouble and things like that when you could replace them with, you know, people to do the jobs? There are, most of the jobs robots do can be done by people. The translator functions that are, that C-3PO really kind of boasts about on a regular basis could be done by an iPad. And I know they didn't have iPads at the time, but to create a robot, or create a mechanism that knows 3 million different kinds of communication, you don't really need to put arms, legs, a head, an arm, and a torso on it. What you basically need is a box. Nonetheless, they've chosen to do this, mostly because George Lucas wanted some comic relief stuff for the movie, and he wasn't allowed to do Step and Fetch It and Mantan Moreland anymore, so rather than having black people be the comic relief, he decided to go with robots, and they are annoying. Both of them are annoying in their own ways. C-3PO is kind of laid out as an effeminate, prissy little golden robot, which is kind of a stereotype of its own, and you can't really understand anything at all R2-D2 says. Even, I mean, looking at the Guardians of the Galaxy, the movie coming out soon, even Groot has three words that you can understand. I am Groot. But no, they got all this beeping and whistling coming out of R2-D2 for no really good reason. There's not actually a plot reason or a character reason or a logical reason why this robot can't talk. And in fact, it would expedite communication with everybody else if it could. Nonetheless, this is what George Lucas has decided to do. And there's the other side to the robots too, which is really, really problematic. And that is the fact that they're intelligent feeling beings, and yet they're slaves. Even the good guys, the rebels, keep slaves in the form of these robots. Now, there's a little bit of a grab from near the start of the movie that demonstrates this really well.
Hey, you're not permitted in there. It's restricted. You'll be deactivated for sure.
So basically, if a robot disobeys orders for any reason, they destroy its mind. And given the fact that these are feeling and more or less sentient beings, basically, for any infraction of the rules, you could get killed. I mean, this whole universe, and this robot was on a rebel spaceship. It wasn't on the bad guy's spaceship. It was on the good guy's spaceship. I mean, the whole thing is, from a robot's point of view, a lot more brutal and nasty than Django Unchained is to black people. And that's a real issue there. They really haven't thought it through. They've decided to set up these comic relief robots, not realizing that what they're actually doing is creating a universe where even the good guys have slaves. And that's an issue. It's stupid and it's ill-considered. But then George Lucas was never a particularly good writer of anything. So let's leave that aside and we'll let that one float for a while. But next up, you got the Jawas. Now, Jawas are little kind of small people in robes who live in the desert, driving an enormous top-heavy tank around the desert until they randomly come upon meandering robots that they steal and sell. Now, the economics of that really is a weird thing. How the hell do you make a living by wandering around an empty desert on the off chance you're going to grab a robot and sell it to somebody? Now, you know, the economic model for that really does suck. And if you have a look too, when Luke and his uncle try to buy some robots from the Jawas, one of the robots, the one that they're going to buy, it's a red R2 unit, blows up when they try to buy it. And the only reaction that Luke and his uncle have is, you know, we'll have the blue one, not actually caring a shit that an intelligent being has just exploded, literally exploded before their very eyes. These people are very, very callous when it comes to other kinds of intelligence in the universe, and they don't deserve us to care a bit about them because of that. You also get that bit, which is in the reconditioned version, or the coloured in version that George Lucas did, where there's a scene with stormtroopers in their white armour looking around for the droids, and one of them is riding an enormous fat lizard thing on tiny little feet. Now, if anybody's tried to drive a car up a sand dune, you've got to know that you've got to have a very wide surface on the surface of a sand dune to really get any traction and not sink into the dune itself. So they've got these lizard things, which for some reason they're riding rather than using, say, cars, for instance, or those little floating things that Luke and the guys go to Mos Eisley on, just so that George Lucas can show how good he is at making monsters, where the physiology of this thing really doesn't make any sense at all. It's just ill-considered, and it's show-offy. That's the whole thing with this reconditioned stuff that Lucas did. He kind of made an announcement that he wanted to fix up the special effects because they weren't as good as he wanted for the films, and it also gave him a chance to re-release some old shit saying it's new shit. And most of the stuff he did was basically meaningless and pointless. It doesn't add anything to the story. There's that scene where Han and Jabba the Hutt meet up, which was, you know, some footage that Lucas had drawn the big slug Jabba the Hutt over that was originally filmed for the first movie. And it doesn't actually add anything to the movie at all. It really, you know, you got to let a movie be an artifact of its time. It's an important thing for a film to stand as itself in the moment in time. I rewatched The Last Starfighter recently, the movie from the early 1980s, which was one of the first films to use computer graphics, and they used a Cray XMP to do the computer graphics for it, and they're very ropey by modern standards, but they are of its time, and they show us what the state of the art was at the time. Now, a Cray XMP, most people's mobile phones have as much computing power as one of those things did back in the early 1980s, and that was considered a supercomputer then. But there's a charm to the simplicity of the special effects in The Last Starfighter that really works, and because it's got a good story and it's a lot of fun, and the aliens are good, and the setup's nice, and the characters are engaging, the movie does hold up really well these days, much better, in fact, in a lot of ways than this movie does. But I'll leave that aside, and we'll leave aside the fact that George Lucas scribbled all over his own homework just so he could make some money on it and test out some new technologies that he wanted to make even more money out of. And make no mistake about it, the whole marketing of Star Wars is about money. It's not about art, because it's not really art. It's craft at best. The technologies are fantastic that they used at the time. The use of computers to control the cameras so that they could do multiple runs through a scene and add special effects to them and all that kind of stuff. Now, all credit to the technicians that Lucas got for doing that and the people who eventually went on to be Industrial Light and Magic. But redrawing them and writing over them shows a disrespect for the audiences in a lot of ways and a kind of acceptance of audience as cash cow, which is kind of offensive. So let's take a break to talk about the actors. You've got Mark Hamill as Luke Skywalker. Looks more like a California beach boy than anything. He doesn't look like somebody who lives on a desert planet because he never wears a hat. And anybody who lives in a tropical climate knows that you wear a hat. Harrison Ford is Han Solo. I've never been impressed with Harrison Ford's acting chops. I think that he's got a few kind of tropes that he uses, and he did get better during his career, but I still think that he's at the shallow end of the acting pool very much, and that shows nowhere better than in this film, where his Han Solo is not that much different than the character he played in American Graffiti. You've got Carrie Fisher. Now, I like Carrie Fisher for a lot of reasons, most of which have to do with the fact that she's a fine writer, and she hasn't taken herself seriously since the making of this film. Yes, she went through a whole bunch of shit, and she's had mental problems, and she's had problems with drugs. And during the making of this film, she was being fucked by Harrison Ford, according to the biography of George Lucas by John Baxter. And then you've got Alec Guinness kind of basically cashing a check to play Obi-Wan Kenobi. And that's the other issue I've got with this one. The original choice for Obi-Wan Kenobi was brilliant, and it really would have worked well, and it would have given the movie a lot more kudos than even having Alec Guinness in it did. They were originally going to go with Toshiro Mifune, because a lot of this film was based on a movie that Kurosawa did with Toshiro Mifune called The Hidden Fortress. And originally they were looking at doing Mifune for the role of Obi-Wan Kenobi, which has got a very kind of Asian-sounding name, of course. And then Lucas decided that it wouldn't work with an Asian actor because it may affect the box office, so they wanted to get somebody big name because most of the stars weren't big name people. And so they went with Alec Guinness and made Obi-Wan Kenobi a Caucasian. And with these three films, you really do notice that kind of casting in the film too. I'll talk that a little bit more when I talk about the second film. But yeah, it's Alec Guinness as Obi-Wan Kenobi, kind of, you know, he has the beautiful tones of a trained British actor. And he still kind of cashes a check. You could see in other films that Alec Guinness really cared more about the property, but I think in this one he did consider himself slumming and he didn't bring his A-game to the film in any way. If you look at him in anything else that he's done, and what he's done is incredibly impressive. Really, yeah, this one isn't one of his best roles by a long shot. Then while we're still on Tatooine, Tusken Raiders. I mean, you got to consider this. The people in this universe can fly in space, but they can't stop terrorists who ride around on giant pig rams and only have small arms as far as the weapons are concerned. So the Tusken Raiders apparently are... It's okay for them to come around and raid people and try to kill them if people get into their territories, but nobody can actually stop them from doing that. It seems a bit stupid. But, of course, this is partly why this film can be considered in some ways a Western to a certain extent, right up to a certain point. And they're the savage Indian kind of characters, only in weird bandaged heads with bits of pipe sticking out of them. So, yeah, then we get to Mos Eisley Spaceport, and you get a lot more of George Lucas rewriting his own images with a lot more CGI, which has absolutely no point. And you get to the cantina scene. Now, there's a couple of things about the cantina scene that I find very problematic. For a start, they're supposed to be in a really rough town, in a really rough bar, in a really rough town. Why the fuck do they have that rinky-dink music playing in a bar where a whole bunch of badass, tough guys are hanging out? I mean, you go into any tough bar and they're going to be playing a lot different music than that. And it's only there because Lucas wanted to play cute with the kids. Yes, he kind of plays up the fact that this is a really rough town and that it's very dangerous and you can get killed just like that. But the music's got to be cute there, so he's got something to offer the kiddies in the scenes. And it's really weird too, because the cantina scenes are quite gruesome. First off, there's the racism against robots, where the bartender won't let robots into his bar. And people just go, yeah, okay, you guys wait outside. Nobody questions it, nobody kind of makes an issue of it. It's a little bit in parallel to a bunch of other films earlier, where there was racism against various other races, predominantly Jewish people and black people in American films. But this is just considered to be okay. And there's a couple of other issues as well. Obi-Wan Kenobi basically cuts off the arm of one of the patrons in the bar in this film, and nobody chucks him out of the pub. Now, I've been in some rough pubs in my time. Not lately, but I have been in some rough pubs. And if you cut a limb off anybody, even in the roughest of rough pubs, you don't just go sitting around. Something is done. You either get your ass thrown out, someone calls the cops, or something else like that. Now, of course, you can say that Obi-Wan Kenobi used his Jedi mind trick, which he'd used on the guards in town, to stop everybody doing that. But eventually somebody's going to trip over the severed arm and basically ask what the fuck. It really doesn't make a lot of sense, that part of the film. And then you get the crap of Han Solo saying he's the best star pilot in the galaxy. Now, that's a stupid statement from any point of view you want to look at. For a start, does he know all the other ones? And that was my phone going off there. Sorry about that. That's one side of it. The other thing is that in the Milky Way, just say his galaxy, and it's in the galaxy far away, a long time ago, and all that kind of shit. Just say his galaxy is the same size as our one, for the sake of arguments. The Milky Way galaxy has 43 stars for every human being currently living on the Earth. The numbers don't add up. If he's the best star pilot in the galaxy, who went around and went to every one of the 300 billion stars in the galaxy and started measuring who's the best star pilot? It really is a dumb statement for even a dumb character like Han Solo, who is very dumb, to make. And then you get Chewbacca as well. And basically, he doesn't serve much of a purpose except giving Han Solo someone to talk to. He's there as a co-pilot, of course, and he's there as muscle, in the same way that Groot is Rocket Raccoon's muscle in The Guardians of the Galaxy. But he doesn't really have much nuance to him. Yes, he'll get pissed off. Yes, he'll throw things around. Yes, he'll occasionally be, you know, the focus of a joke. But the non-human characters anywhere in this movie series, with one exception, are basically stereotypes that were previously fulfilled by other races in these kind of films. So there's that as well. And the bit with Greedo shooting first or Han Solo shooting first, I don't care who shot first. For a start, how can you miss a shot at a range of 1 meter? Now, Greedo misses Han Solo's head, which is not an inconsiderable size, particularly given 1970s hairstyles. But how the fuck do you miss a shot at a range of slightly above 1 meter? And neither of them, when they're in negotiation, says to the other one, which would make sense in any negotiation of this type, keep both of your hands above the table. Neither of them do that because both of them are just there so that everyone can have the point demonstrated that Han Solo is a tough guy. It's very clumsy writing and could have been done a lot better. Now, I'm going to cut through a lot of the shit in Star Wars, the first movie, to kind of get to a couple of other plot points that I want to make. First off, isn't Princess Leia supposed to be a diplomat? She's rude to everybody that she meets in this first movie. Well, they come in to rescue her, and she's laying there in a sultry pose just after she's been tortured by a floating robot. Now, I don't know anybody who gets tortured and then suddenly kind of lays on a bench in a sultry pose. I'm not sure it's something that people really do in any way at all. But she's rude to them when they come to rescue her. She's dismissive of them, trying to get her out of the Death Star. She takes over the shooting part of things a little bit and kind of helps out with the rescue. But in general, she's just a pain in the ass. And I suppose you can get away with it when you're the only human woman in three movies, apart from Luke's aunt, who ends up being a crispy critter. And that's the other thing, too. Luke's aunt and uncle get killed by the stormtroopers and all of that kind of stuff and get fried until they're basically crispy skeletons. But everybody else who gets shot by a blaster in these films doesn't get fried at all. They just basically have a hole punched in them and fall down. But to make the plot point that Lucas wanted to make, he decided he was going to go a bit John Ford on this and turn Owen and Beru into crispy critters. Again, it's like special case stuff when he wanted to make a plot point. But anyway, we get to the Death Star, and Luke Skywalker kills his first human being, one of the stormtroopers, and doesn't even bat an eyelid. Yes, they're in the middle of a firefight, but this is a kid who basically spent his entire life on a desert planet living on a farm, and suddenly he's killing people. But there's no even acknowledgement of that anywhere in the film. There's no kind of, yes, I know that they're the bad guys, but you can't really kill a human being if you're at all sane and not have some kind of psychological repercussion. This is a very, very big thing, and a thing that transgresses everything we know of human psychology. And yet, nothing is made of it at all. Even a kind of little moment of introspection and quiet might have been called for, just to acknowledge the fact that this is a tough and a difficult thing for a human being to do. But then Luke Skywalker is a psychopath. You hear him talking about the shooting womp rats in a canyon or something like that to prove his chops as a pilot as the film progresses. So basically, this is a farm boy who goes out and shoots random wildlife for amusement. So, you know, he's probably a little bit on the way to being a serial killer anyway. So they're on the Death Star, they've rescued Princess Leia, they've got out of the garbage crushing thing and all that kind of stuff, and Obi-Wan Kenobi has turned off the tractor beam and suddenly meets his former student, Darth Vader. And then they have one of the lamest dueling scenes in human history. Now, I know Alec Guinness had raked up a few birthdays at this stage, but there are ways to film a dueling scene, even with an actor of a certain age, that is exciting. But this one is slow and ponderous and lazy. It's lazy directing and editing and really doesn't do much at all. And the dialogue during the fight scene between Obi-Wan Kenobi and Darth Vader is some of the lamest dialogue in this very lame movie trilogy. It really is. It doesn't zing at all. If you're having a duel with somebody, even if you're trying to put across serious point, you've got to have some punch to the dialogue as a counterpoint to the action. The dialogue enhances the action if you do it right, but in this movie, it really doesn't happen.
I've been waiting for you, Obi-Wan. We meet again at last. The circle is now complete. When I left you, I was but the learner. Now I am the master.
Only a master of evil, Darth.
Your powers are weak, old man.
You can't win, Darth. If you strike me down, I shall become more powerful than you can possibly imagine.
For a start, how does he become more powerful? He doesn't really, he just turns into a ghost. So the dialogue's bullshit anyway. And then you've got the other thing too, where basically Obi-Wan Kenobi commits suicide by letting Darth Vader cut his costume in half while he turns into the magical ghost. And he does it before the other people are entirely on board the Millennium Falcon and ready to go. So Luke Skywalker nearly gets killed anyway because he sees Darth Vader kill Obi-Wan Kenobi and he tries to go over to help. Whereas if Obi-Wan Kenobi had a lick of sense, he would have made sure that Luke and them were on the ship first and told him to go, I'll hold them off, and not let himself be killed until after they were gone, which makes the sacrifice even more poignant. But no, they've got to kind of have more and more of that really, really boring blaster shooting. There's all these scenes of people shooting at each other with these blasters, and to no real purpose apart from the fact they're trying to enhance the action. It really pisses me off a lot. And then you've got the stormtroopers in their little white suits of armour running around the place. It kind of reminded me of Emperor Wang's guards running around Planet Porno in Flesh Gordon. It's very much along similar lines. If you look at the bits of Emperor Wang's guards running up and down the corridors chasing after Flesh Gordon, there's a lot of parallels between that and the stormtroopers in Star Wars. Then we get to going onto the Yavin and finding out that there's one weak point on the Death Star and that only a really good pilot will be able to go down this big long trench and shoot this little 2-meter hole with a torpedo and set off a chain reaction that blows up the whole space station. For a start, nobody's going to design a space station like that. For another thing, why go down that enormous long trench to do it? It looks to me like the thing's open to the air. It was open to space. So why not, at very, very least, cut down into the trench a lot closer to the target and then blow it up there? But no, the whole point is to get all of this action going, to see a whole bunch of people fail at it, to get Alec Guinness to tell him to use the Force rather than using computer technology, which in this universe doesn't tend to work very well anyway. And use the Force and save the day. But the whole reason for the trench shot is because George Lucas saw a really good similar scene in a movie called 12 O'Clock High, and he'd seen the Dam Busters, and he wanted to emulate those kind of things. But in those movies, there was actually a purpose to that long lead-in before you hit your target. In this movie, there's no purpose apart from the fact that George Lucas wants to build up the tension. It's artificially created, and anybody with common sense can pick holes in it. I've seen kids who watch this movie for the first time and go, why do they do that? And why do they do this? And all that kind of stuff. It's really bad movie making and bad storytelling, because the whole point And of course, it's influenced a lot of computer games afterwards, where there's a dumb thing that you've got to go through real hardships to get, even though there's a way around it. And then you do one simple thing and everything blows up. So anyway, they blow up the Death Star. Darth Vader goes spinning away and gets away to be in the other two movies, and then the three after that. Han Solo comes back and saves the day. I mean, why not take the money and run? Han Solo is a businessman. He's actually done what he was paid to do. He wants to get his money and to go away. There's nothing at all wrong with that. But Princess Leia gives him a lot of shit for it. Even though he's kept his agreement, he wants to be paid for it, and he wants to go. And, of course, he comes back because he's the kind of naughty boy hero. But her giving him shit for it really is a bit churlish. You can't recruit people into a rebellion by browbeating them into it. You've got to let them come to it in their own way. But this movie, pretty much everybody's petulant, except for, with a possible exception of, well, actually, I can't think of anybody who's not petulant in this film. Maybe Obi-Wan Kenobi to a certain extent, but the rest of them are just basically undeserving of our regard and attention. So anyway, the Death Star blows up. Thousands of people die. A whole bunch of really good pilots on their side die. And they have this great big Lenny Riefenstahl-style award ceremony where the heroes get medals from Princess Leia, and everybody's smirking and everybody's happy, and they cut to the John Williams music again. And that's the thing, the John Williams music. I hate John Williams music. John Williams music I dislike for one simple reason. It's over the top. It's too much for what it's trying to do. It's bombastic and obvious, and it so very intensely tries to manipulate your feelings during the film that it becomes intrusive and becomes offensive as well. Now, John Williams' music in this film obviously influenced by people like Eric Wolfgang Korngold and Max Steiner and those guys, but those guys, their music wasn't used so intrusively as this music is in Star Wars. They know when, well, the people making the films that their music appeared in knew when to back off a little bit and when to do things, when not to make it glaringly obvious that the music's there to hype up your emotions for a particular scene that doesn't play very strongly anyway. But John Williams does that. I mean, he started out doing some pretty good music. He did some good music for television, for instance, which was very quirky and idiosyncratic. Things like the TV series Checkmate, and even the stuff he did for Irwin Allen in things like The Time Tunnel is kind of interesting music, but this stuff is just derivative of better composers. And I find it really a bit irksome for that reason. It's like a lot of Spielberg's use of John Williams and other people's music. I don't mind a movie and its music seducing you, but I really hate when it jams a cold hand down the front of your pants and tries to jerk you off. And for me, the Star Wars music does that. So anyway, I'm going to take a break now, and then when I get back, I'm going to get into the second film, The Empire Strikes Back. That was John Williams' music to The Time Tunnel, which is better music than he did for Star Wars, in my opinion. And yes, people are going to scream at me for that. I don't care. This one came out in, he said, looking this up, 1980, which is 3 years after the first one came out. The script was written by Lee Brackett, who's a famous science fiction writer. Her Shamblow and a bunch of other her stories were really good. She also worked on The Big Sleep and a number of other films, noir, in the 1940s, so she's got a good street cred there. Lawrence Kasdan also wrote the script, and George Lucas wrote the film story, whatever that means in this context. From what I can understand, George Lucas didn't like Lee Brackett's version of the script and wanted her to rewrite it. Unfortunately, she dropped dead of cancer and wasn't able to do so. The idea of George Lucas sending back work from somebody who has the credibility and the skills of Lee Brackett seems to me a bit wrong. It'd be very interesting one day to see Lee Brackett's script for The Empire Strikes Back, just to see who was right and who was wrong from an aesthetic and an objective point of view. But anyway, this movie, a lot of people say it's the best of the three, and I can understand why they do, even though the best of the three is a difficult point for me. It was directed by Irvin Kershner. He was a pretty okay director. He did a couple of good things. Probably one of the best things he did was The Luck of Ginger Coffee in 1964, which I like a lot. I haven't seen it in a while. I've actually got to take a look at it again very soon, with Robert Shaw in it. He also did a movie that I've talked about on Paleo Cinema a long time ago called A Fine Madness with Sean Connery and Gene Seberg. In 1967, he did The Flim Flam Man, which starred George C. Scott and Michael Sarrazin. He then went downhill and did a Barbara Streisand movie in 1972 called Up the Sandbox. The Return of a Man Called Horse, The Eyes of Laura Mars with Faye Dunaway. Then he did this, and 3 years later did Never Say Never Again, the one rogue James Bond film, the last one Connery did, which isn't considered part of the canon, but I kind of like it. He also did 1990 Robocop 2, and then went downhill and made a Steven Seagal movie in 1994. But, you know, he was a jobbing director. Not one of those ones that draws attention to his work, but he knew how to write characters, and he knew how to direct characters and knew how to direct actors. And probably anything positive that came out of this movie would probably be a combination of anything of Lee Brackett's that survived the process of script writing and Irvin Kershner. So basically, I find a pricey for the story of this film, but even though everybody knows it, I'll kind of give you a little bit of a background. People say it's the darkest of the three movies, which it probably is because it doesn't have any teddy bears in it. But here we go. Again, this one is from IMDb, and it says, after the rebels have been brutally overpowered by the Empire on their newly established base in Hoth, Luke Skywalker takes advanced Jedi training with Master Yoda while his friends are pursued by Darth Vader as a part of his plan to capture Luke. And, yep, so that's pretty much it. You don't need to know too much else about it. So it starts out on the ice planet Hoth, where they, for some reason they've made Luke some kind of guerrilla leader, even though he knows fuck all about living on an ice planet, coming from a desert planet as he does. And this is shown soon when basically a Yeti beats him up and kills the Tauntaun he's riding, and they ride two-legged kind of things, a combination of a kangaroo and a ram. Ends up with the Tauntaun dead, Luke hanging upside down from the ceiling of an ice cave while the Yeti that gets him is eating somebody else. So Luke's knocked out, his lightsaber's on the ground. I can't figure out how his feet got attached to the ceiling of the ice cave. The only thing I can figure out is that the Yeti held his feet against the roof of the ice cave and then did a bubbler kind of thing and pissed up around Luke's feet, and the piss froze to form a layer holding his shoes to the ceiling. That's the only thing that I can explain that with. It's the only logical explanation, is that the Yeti pissed upwards and froze Luke's feet to the ice cave. So Luke wakes up just in time, and he slices himself out of the ice ceiling with his lightsaber. He then cuts the arm off the Yeti and leaves it to die in agony in the cave, while he runs away and ends up half frozen. And Han Solo finds him, jams him inside the still warm but dead body of the Tauntaun, which the guts of Tauntauns, by the way, seem to be entirely composed out of condoms and milk for some reason. So yeah, and then there's a big fight, and those stupid AT-AT things come along. The Empire has these great big four-legged things that look like kind of giant robot camels, and all it takes is some guy in a in a kind of airship with a tow rope to beat them. So you just trip them up, they fall over, that's it. But anyway, the base gets overrun and everybody pisses off. Luke then goes and decides he's going to Dagobah to have Jedi training with Master Yoda, and everybody in the audience realizes that the little green guy with the ears is Master Yoda long before Luke Skywalker ever does. And he starts doing Mr. Miyagi shit with Luke Skywalker in something which should have been done as one of those 1980s training montages with Eye of the Tiger playing over them, but instead they drag out for way too long with lots of stupid philosophical shit Yoda is saying. I mean, the guy, Yoda is a weird character because he's 900 years old and he still hasn't worked out the syntax of English. And so they have him there, but the good thing about Yoda and the best thing about Yoda is he's the most realistic character in any of the Star Wars movies. And that's all thanks to the puppeteering and the voice work by Frank Oz. He brings a puppet to life a lot more than Mark Hamill or Carrie Fisher or Harrison Ford do with live characters. And the movie actually lifts when Yoda's on the screen because there's an artistry there that's not in the rest of the people's work. And that's kind of cool. But having said that, there are other problems with it. And I'll go back to my big list here. Let's see. The rescue aircraft who were looking for Luke on the ice planet were interesting too, because they're all flying really low and really fast while they're trying to look for him. This is a little bit odd because if you know anything about search and rescue aircraft, they fly pretty high and try not to fly too quickly because you can miss things. But not in this one. They rip across the landscape really quickly and they're all supposed to find something in an ice planet landscape while traveling at high speed at low altitude. That's pretty fucked, really. And then when they get Luke back and he's in hospital getting healed up, most of which he spends in an enormous test tube with a breathing mask on, you get this piece of dialogue. This shows you the sparkle and the wit of the dialogue that you get in this movie, and it's woeful.
I don't know where you get your delusions, laser brain.
So that's Princess Leia giving an insult to Han Solo while Chewbacca laughs in the background. Yeah, laser brain. It's got to be a really odd insult, laser brain, because for me, lasers are something that's sharp and accurate and precise. It's not something you'd use if you want to talk about somebody being stupid. It's just really bad dialogue. And really, you know, but either this woman is in some way functionally retarded or the writers really didn't like Carrie Fisher. It's just a woeful piece of dialogue, and it takes you totally out of the movie while you go, no, that should be a good thing. It shouldn't be a bad thing. And that's the kind of thing, I mean, Harrison Ford's character, Han Solo, let's assume he's the same age as Harrison Ford. So you've got a 35-year-old guy playing the kind of cute insult romance shit and bragging about how Princess Leia told him her true feelings in a corridor somewhere, and all this kind of shit. I mean, yeah, I was pretty dumb at 35 too, but I'm not sure if it got quite that dumb. Well, maybe I did, but either way, it's not something, you know, this is supposed to be an admirable character. This is supposed to be one of the great romances of science fiction cinema. And it comes across really fucking lame. Somebody show these people a Billy Wilder comedy or something, for fuck's sake, because they're not doing any good with this. And there's not a lot of chemistry between the actors either. Even when they do admit their feelings later on in the second and the third movie and all that kind of stuff, it's just not there. Now, how much of this is to do with Carrie Fisher's problems and how much of it's to do with Harrison Ford being an asshole? I don't know. But either way, the lightning's just not there. So Luke heads off to Dagobah, the swamp planet, because every planet's just one thing in this universe, remember? And he travels in one of those little kind of cockpit spaceships with R2-D2 and a little alcove behind him. And the really weird and fucked up thing about that is it's got to be a fairly long trip between one planet and another, really, even at those speeds. And if you're stuck in a kind of fighter pilot cockpit for a long time, either they took out the ejector seat to put in a commode, or you are going to be swimming in your own urine by the time you get there. It really is one of those things that's not thought out. Give him a slightly bigger spaceship so he's at least got room for a bunk bed. You know, something about the size of a semi-trailer cabin would be useful. But no, they decide they're going to do the little one because it looks good and they can sell the toys a lot better than they could something larger. And remember, Star Wars movies are all about the toys. So he gets there, Swamp Planet, his aircraft kind of sinks, but again, by some miracle of geography and magic, he lands, you know, a couple of hundred meters away from exactly where he needs to be, which is Yoda's little place, which looks like Fraggles live in it, pretty much. And, Yoda starts teaching him and showing him how to levitate things and how to stand on both hands with Yoda on your foot and all that kind of stuff, which is incredibly useful training when you want to stand on your hands. And all of this goes on while the rest of them fly into an asteroid field to dodge the bad guys and then fly inside an asteroid, which turns out to be inside the gullet of some kind of space worm that lives in asteroids, leaving aside the fact that that's pretty fucking stupid. They had to kill time some way. And then they head off to Bespin and the floating city and the clouds above what looks like a minor gas giant, where they meet their good friend Lando Calrissian, one of the two black people in the Star Wars universe. And he's played by Billy Dee Williams, who's bringing on the suave and bringing on the charisma, and is about 25 times as charismatic as Han Solo, and starts macking on Princess Leia. She's charmed, but she doesn't bite for it, though. To be honest with you, I was kind of hoping that she'd hook up with Lando Calrissian, because he seems a much better deal than the smart-ass and kind of very clueless Han Solo, whose virtues elude me throughout the three movies. But anyway, he takes them into the city, which is kind of slightly art deco, and there are things like enormous bug zappers in the middle of little courtyards and all sorts of weird shit like that. It's a very kind of generic and neat city. All the cities in the Star Wars movies tend to look like shopping malls that were designed by people who took too many pharmaceuticals. They've got an antiseptic and pristine look about them. But any of the cities in Star Wars movies aren't places where you'd really like to live. I'm just talking about these three movies. I'm not expanding it beyond the three, but yeah, they're kind of the places where, you know, somebody would shoot you for dropping a piece of litter. And so they're not entirely comfortable places. So R2-D2's with Luke Skywalker. C-3PO gets blasted into chunks by something we don't quite know what is, and then the Wookiee's got to try to put him together, and this is what passes for humour in the second movie, which, yeah, admittedly, it is the darkest of the three, but they still haven't got humour right in any reasonable sense of the word. And even for kids, the humour's a bit kind of lame-ass and rather embarrassing. So, you see, Yoda basically shows Luke Skywalker how to get his spaceship out of the swamp. And they don't show you, what they don't show you, of course, is what they have to do to get a spaceship to function after it's been immersed in swamp water for a number of weeks or months. But, again, this is a Star Wars movie, so there's all that magical hand-waving. Now, in the version I saw, I'm getting ahead of myself there. So, anyway, of course, Billy Dee Williams has betrayed them to keep his city and the local economy going. He's saying he's got a small operation there, but if you have a look at the way the city's laid out in the movie, it's about the size of Manhattan Island. So when he's talking about a small operation, it's not really a small operation. But anyway, he gives Han Solo to Darth Vader and those guys. Han Solo gets immersed in a block of carbonite, and Princess Leia decides that she likes him that way and she's in love with him. So you've got that there. And then Boba Fett comes and grabs Han Solo, and they've dubbed Temuera Morrison's voice in as Boba Fett. So Temuera Morrison played Boba Fett paid some kind of Fett anyway, in the second three movies. So they've gone back and they've actually dubbed in an actor who was like 10 years old when this movie was made. They've dubbed his voice in just to give consistency to all six movies. And it's really interesting because, you know, suddenly they got Boba Fett is a kind of lame character because in the first three movies he's got a mask on his head, mostly because the actor Jeremy Bullock wasn't very pretty. But I kind of get the impression that Boba Fett grabs the frozen Han Solo, goes off somewhere and has a hungy, and then takes him to Jabba the Hutt, which we see in the third movie. And so things are getting very dark there. Luke Skywalker has a sword fight with Darth Vader, which again is a bit of a sluggish thing. Darth Vader says, "I'm your daddy," and Luke Skywalker goes, "No, you're not," in a very whiny, bitchy little voice. So Darth Vader cuts his hand off, and Luke falls down a vent and hangs off the underneath part of the city until they pick him up. Because Princess Leia gets a telepathic email from him. So the Millennium Falcon picks him up, and then they go to the Rebels, and the Rebels give Luke Skywalker a robot hand instead of a really cool hook or a built-in lightsaber or something like that. And the movie ends. So that's basically it. All that happens is Luke Skywalker gets some training. Han Solo gets frozen in a block of shit, and everybody gets really unhappy, and a few plot bombs are dropped into it. And that's it. So, now it's time for another break, and then I'll get on with the third one, The Empire Strikes Back, and we can wrap this puppy up. That was the theme to Checkmate, another piece of television music by John Williams, which was better than the stuff he did for Star Wars. So we flash forward to 1983 and Return of the Jedi, which gets slightly less on the IMDb scale than the second one did. So here we go, storyline from IMDb. Darth Vader and the Empire are building a new indestructible Death Star. Yes, right. Meanwhile, Han Solo has been imprisoned in a block of carbonite, and Luke Skywalker has sent R2-D2 and C-3PO to try and free him. Princess Leia disguised as a bounty hunter and Chewbacca go along as well. The final battle takes place on the moon of Endor with its natural inhabitants, the Ewoks, lending a hand to the Rebels. Will Darth Vader and the Dark Side overcome the Rebels and take over the universe, which they already took over? So that's one from IMDb. So, the movie starts out with people trying to rescue Han Solo. So, as it says there, the robots get sent in as a gift from Luke Skywalker to Jabba the Hutt. Princess Leia infiltrates his place, dressed as some kind of cosplay samurai bounty hunter. And she does one of the dumber things of the series, really, which is she actually thaws Han Solo out of the block of carbonite using the little push panel on the side of the block of carbonite before she escapes. Now, this is kind of dumb, because if it was me and you know that somebody's going to be in a bad way, he's actually temporarily blind and incredibly weak for being locked up in this block of black shit, what I'd be doing is I'd be getting a trolley and just wheeling him out, and I'd be thawing him out later. But no, they don't do that. They decide they're going to do it the other way so it looks more poignant. Then, of course, they all get caught. Yep, Luke Skywalker gets caught. He gets dropped into a pit with a giant monster called a Rancor, which shows you the level of thought that goes into the naming of monsters in the Star Wars movies. He kills it, making the guy who owns the Rancor very unhappy. They get taken out on a barge to a giant pit where Audrey 2 from Little Shop of Horrors is waiting at the bottom of the pit to eat them. R2-D2 and C-3PO are there, so R2-D2 ejaculates a lightsaber, which Luke Skywalker grabs. Oh yes, I forgot the other part too. Meanwhile, after she gets caught, Princess Leia gets turned into a sex slave by Jabba the Hutt, who dresses her up in a cosplay bikini kind of outfit and licks her face a lot and generally acts like he's going to be doing the dirty boogie with her at any minute, which is kind of tacky. And for that, when all shit breaks loose on the barges and Luke starts swinging the lightsaber around, Princess Leia then decides that she's going to loop the chain that she's being held on around Jabba the Hutt's neck and chokes him to death just before everybody's rescued and they fly away. So there's that. So Audrey 2 gets to eat Boba Fett, which is kind of cool. And Luke then goes back to the swamp world, Dagobah, so that Yoda can have a death scene, and confirms that Luke's father was Hayden Christensen and is currently living in a costume designed to look like a 1950s Studebaker hearse. So the Empire's building another Death Star because they still haven't figured out that the best way to fuck up a planet is to drop a rock on it. The one that killed the dinosaurs was 6 miles long. All they needed to do was put a jet or rocket on the back end of a 12-mile-long asteroid and pummel any planet they like with it, and then just threaten them that way. But no, they decide that what they've got to do instead is build a moon-sized space station with lots and lots of people that they've got to pay wages to, and just so they can hold a giant laser beam. This doesn't strike me as economical. If you want to destroy a planet, throw a rock at it. If it was good enough to kill the dinosaurs, it's good enough to kill anybody else. But no, they decided that they didn't want to do this. They wanted to have the big fancy shit. Now, we knew about giant asteroids hitting planets at the time of this movie. It's not something new that we knew. But instead, the Empire decides to build another Death Star because things went so well with the first one. So the Emperor rocks up as well, and he's played by Ian McDiarmid, who's really pissed off because the Galactic Empire, which can do faster than light travel and create intelligent robots and make cities that sit in gas giants, still haven't worked out a way to do really good reconstructive facial surgery. So he comes on all creepy and pedophilic, and like a Catholic bishop, he wants Darth Vader to groom Luke Skywalker to the dark side of the Force because there's no Operation U-Tree in this universe. And he's generally acting really fucked up creepy. So near the construction of this Death Star is Endor, a forest moon, because remember, every planet only has one thing in this universe. So everybody goes to Endor and basically meet up with H. Beam Piper's little fuzzies, which Lucas stole and called Ewoks. Now, these Ewoks are really fortunate creatures because they're all small, they're all uncoordinated, they're all not very bright, and if somebody had dropped, a herd of dingoes or some feral cats onto the planet, they probably would have been killed by feral cats and dingoes. Because from the look of things, there's absolutely no natural predator for small fuzzy things that can't move very fast on Endor. But they are very good at creating booby traps, which they should have told the Rebels how to do in the first movie, because they weren't very good at doing booby traps. So Luke decides that he's going to help Daddy Vader to redeem himself, in spite of the fact that Daddy Vader destroyed an entire planet of people, telekinetically choked to death unknown numbers of bureaucrats, and cut off his hand. He decides he wants to redeem his daddy, because this is an American movie, and parents always have to redeem themselves, however much of a psychopathic prick they are. So it's not his fault, you see, that he got seduced by the angry side of the Force, because nobody is allowed to vent any emotions if they're a Jedi. They've all got to be cool and calm and just basically the sort of person who shoots womp rats as a teenage diversion and doesn't give a shit when they kill people. So everyone's got to hold it all in. If you're a Jedi, you've got to be cool and calm and collected under everything, so you can use the Force to do important things like levitating robots in chairs and mind-fucking the intellectually disabled for your own purposes. So Luke goes to the Death Star while the heroes work out a computer game scenario where they zoom through the guts of the space station, fritz out an enormous bug zapper in the middle of it, and get out before the Death Star blows up. So Luke and Darth Vader fight again, and then the Emperor gets involved, and the Emperor starts acting like Nigel Green did in the movie The Ruling Class, playing the electric Jesus.
Who else has electricity streaming from his eyeballs and from his fingers? I'm the High Voltage Messiah, the Electric Christ, the AC/DC God. I've not traveled 20 million miles through galactic space to bandy words with epoxy moon loony one million zones. votes. 2 million votes. 3 million votes. 4 million votes. 5 million votes. 6 million votes. 7 million votes. 8 million votes.
Yeah, so anyway, the Emperor acts like that. And Darth Vader gets a bit sooky, and as is his nature, as we find out in the next three movies. And he picks up the Emperor and chucks him down a pit, and the Emperor's dead. And Darth Vader dies because of this, because he's got electrocuted to fuck by the Emperor. And he decides he wants to see some with his own eyes, so Luke Skywalker helps him take his helmet off. And he looks like a bald character actor playing a harmonica. So Darth Vader dies, and the good guys then manage to blow up the Death Star in a move that looks a lot like a computer game, because it was probably designed to be created into a computer game. And then everybody has a party with the Ewoks on the Ewok planet, and the Ewoks have only discovered two bits of technology, really, which is spears, or three bits, spears, booby traps, and percussion instruments. And so everybody's happy because the Empire has died, because all it takes to destroy a galaxy-wide empire is to blow up one Death Star. And that's the end of the movies. Now, I did have a list of people who I thought would be better in the roles in Star Wars movies than these guys. And it's a pretty good list, so I'm going to share it with you now before I finish this puppy up. So I decided that playing Han Solo, you'd either go old and have Warren Oates do it. Warren Oates would have been a good Han Solo. Or I looked at actors who are the same age as Harrison Ford and decided that the best person to play Ian McShane wasn't Christopher Walken.
I'm captain of the Millennium Falcon. Chewie here tells me you're looking for passage to the Alderaan system.
Yes, indeed, if it's a fast ship.
Fast ship? You've never heard of the Millennium Falcon. It's the ship that made the Kessel Run in less than 12 parsecs. She's fast enough for you, old man.
But it's somebody else, and my choice for playing Han Solo would have been Ian McShane. Now, Luke Skywalker. Now, this person actually went for the role of Han Solo, but was considered too young to play Han Solo. So I reckon Kurt Russell would have been a terrific Luke Skywalker. He would have been the best. Princess Leia, there's only one choice for person to play Princess Leia, and that would have been Jenny Agutter, who was in Logan's Run and Walkabout and all those other movies, and appeared in the Avengers movie recently. C-3PO, there's really only one choice, and that person is, again, an English actor, and a fine one at that, and that would be John Inman, who was in that famous British comedy, Are You Being Served?
Well, you see, it should have been Luke. It says so on the instructions. Luke.
R2-D2 should have been played by Kazoo. And let me have a look at my list again. Lando Calrissian, probably Rudy Ray Moore, though I'll settle for Billy Dee Williams, really. The voice of Darth Vader should have been Christopher Lee, because Christopher Lee rocks. Obi-Wan Kenobi, the only person to play that should have been Toshiro Mifune, as was the original choice. You can't go past Mifune. He's got the street cred. He's done Kurosawa films. He's kick-ass and he's fun. And Grand Moff Tarkin, the character played by Peter Cushing in the first movie, should have been played by either Peter Cushing or Anton Differing, who played a whole bunch of those kind of roles. So that's about it for the Star Wars thing. I've got a little bit of feedback I want to read out, which came before the podcast. Tim Libby sent me this nice little note saying, Terry, I think you're too harsh on the original Star Wars movies. I heard your comments in last week's Paleo Cinema. I love it as a fun romp of a rocket and ray gun movie. Flash Gordon done with the money and care nobody had ever brought to it before. Left on its own, which even Lucas didn't do, it's great popcorn entertainment. The problem was that it made a shit ton of money and sucked all of the air out of the room for any SF movies that didn't have dogfights in space and pew-pew-pew laser battles. Worse, Joseph Campbell got his mitts on it and started blathering about the hero's journey and the heroic saga archetypes, and Lucas gobbled it up with a spoon as if every adventure story doesn't inherently have those themes. I live with a writer who the same thing Lucas did, only for girls. Tamora Pierce's The Song of the Lioness is the hero's journey with all the trimming, same as Star Wars is, only for girls, so I suspect it doesn't even count in Campbell's or Lucas's very patriarchal eyes. Every other movie in the series since the original Star Wars has been a retcon trying to consciously inject those mythical archetype hero's journey saga elements into what was at bottom a goofy, fun, big-budget Saturday matinee. Thanks for that, Tim. And yeah, I'm willing to believe Tamora's version of it. So again, that is Tamora Pierce's Song of the Lioness. And I'm going to have to track that down now. Damn you. But thanks for that, Tim. Yeah, the first one I think really could have been better had it been handled by somebody else. I mean, the argument could be made that it may not have been made if it was done by somebody else. But I really think that the micromanagement and the level of control that Lucas had on the project and had on the subsequent projects has worked to the detriment of the whole lot, and indeed to science fiction as a whole. Now, there were, before Star Wars, science fiction films, surprisingly enough, for those who didn't know that. And I think we're now recovering from the legacy of Star Wars, which was that kind of eye kick visuals above all else, special effects based Star Wars type science fiction films. It has set the genre back a long way, and it's only now that we're really coming out from under that shadow. I don't think that the new ones, when they come out, will be as mythically successful as the first Star Wars movie. J.J. Abrams, I've got my doubts about what he did with the second of the new Star Trek movies. Leads me to think that he doesn't really give a shit and he's just trying to increase his brand name recognition. But we'll soon see, and I'm sure that there are a number of people listening to this podcast who are really hanging out to see the new Star Wars movies with the broken-legged Han Solo and all the rest of it. But to be honest with you, I'm not. I think that there are many, many better movies out there. There are movies that have a lot more to say. There are movies that have more things to say about... I mean, there's very, very little gender equality in Star Wars, even when they did the last three movies. The only thing that Natalie Portman's character, the princess, was there for basically was to give birth to twins and to be a love interest for a sooky little prick who ends up being Darth Vader. So, yeah, that's about it for the Star Wars movies. Thank you again to Jane and to Matt and to dear, dear Shane, who is hanging out to hear this podcast, to hear me diss the thing he loves most in the world apart from everything else he loves. And, but anyway, that's about it for this one. It's been a lot harder to do than a lot of other ones because talking about movies I don't like is a lot harder than talking about movies I do like. But nonetheless, I've got through it and I fulfill my obligation, and I hope that Jane in particular, this has done justice to what you requested. So I'll be back in 2 weeks with another one. I'll be back in a week with another Paleo Cinema podcast with my new friend Armin from Germany, chiming in. So anyway, look after yourselves in the meantime. Keep watching the skies, and I'll be back very soon with another podcast.